crabs and clams and shellfish are the things that we think are sort of at the front lines of harm from ocean acidification.
A look at changes in Alaska waters from ocean acidification. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Juneau explores the housing first model for its homeless population.
The number of emergency room visits, the number of police pickups, the number of criminal charges, they drop so significantly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Coastal communities in Alaska that depend on fisheries were warned today to prepare for the impacts of ocean acidification. A study from federal agencies says many of the science questions remain unanswered, but changes are already happening. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The first concern is likely shellfish, because when the chemistry of the ocean changes, it's harder for them to form shells. But which commercial shellfish and when they might be affected and in what waters are questions they can't answer yet. But what the study can say is which communities are most vulnerable. This is the first product from the synthesis of Arctic research effort that combines the work of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration with that of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and university researchers in social sciences. Co-author Dr. Sarah Cooley, who wrote the report while at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and is now scientific outreach manager at the Ocean Conservancy, says Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, and the Lakin Peninsula Borough are specifically named because they're fishing towns.
And what we find is that dependence on fisheries is really the key link between ocean chemistry conditions and human communities. Right now in Alaska, we have a very heavy dependence on specific harvests. And those specific harvests of crabs and clams and shellfish are actually the things that we think are sort of at the front lines of harm from ocean acidification.
Acidity is directly related to rising levels of carbon dioxide in the air. It is worst in colder waters and in meltwater. To the north in the Chukchi Sea, measurements show the cold, acidic water from below increasingly rising to meet the cold, acidic waters at the surface with largely unknown biological effects. Of particular concern are the shell-dependent plankton, krill, and copepods, and little aquatic snails known as pteropods, which are heavily fed on by pink salmon. But acidity also affects the tiny squid that the king salmon eat.
Some species of squid respond poorly to ocean acidification, too, because they have such a high metabolic rate that they can't exhale as efficiently.
That's called an indirect effect in the study. They just can't say what might be happening to salmon and other finfish because of it. Cooley says it is a big and complicated ecosystem out there.
I think there are more surprises in store because, you know, ecosystems are amazingly resilient. But I would love it if we could figure out where the surprises are going to be before we have nasty surprises, like in the Pacific Northwest, when we had nasty surprises of sudden losses of oysters. I'm hoping we can figure it out before we have more losses for people.
In the case of oysters, the fix turned out to be doable. It just took monitoring. When the acid waters shoal up, the oyster farmers change timing, depth, or even dose their larvae with antacids. It took them time to learn all this. And Sarah Cooley says that's the real point of this report. It's an effort to try to start getting ahead of the acidity change curve.
When we start to do studies like this, we can actually kind of go under the hood and figure out the pieces that make a community more or less likely to be hurt. And so we can try to fix those ahead of time.
Cooley says the options include diversification and securing local government control, what might simply mean things like changing fishing areas and times. But certainly, better monitoring of acidity levels is going to be key for adaptation by coastal communities in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A group of researchers set out from Unalaska this week to a remote part of the Central Aleutians, the Islands of the Four Mountains. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, the 16 scientists are beginning a three-year mission in territory that's unpredictable and largely unexplored.
The weather was clear and sunny in Dutch Harbor this past Saturday while the research team loaded up their charter vessel with food and supplies. As most of them know from experience in this part of Alaska, conditions can change in an instant. Still, lead archaeologist Dixie West was hoping for the best.
I'm expecting fair skies and wonderful winds, and that we're going to find some exciting information about how volcanic impacts and tsunamis impacted prehistoric humans.
West works with the University of Kansas. She headed out to the uninhabited Islands of the Four Mountains on Sunday. With her, a group of experts who study volcanoes, tsunamis, earthquakes, climate and biology, and prehistoric settlements. This will be the first year of a three-year expedition funded in part by the National Science Foundation. Next year is more fieldwork, and in year three, they'll write up their findings. West and the others will stage their research on Chuganaydak Island, near one of the most active volcanoes in the Aleutian chain, Mount Cleveland. They'll be working in the volcano's shadow, studying how prehistoric Unangan peoples might have lived there.
So hopefully we'll be able to add something to modern information about how people should expect volcanoes to behave and how possibly better to react to them.
Most of the researchers took a boat to the island group, a few followed by helicopter, the same one that'll transport them between the ship and the island's shore, since there isn't a dock in the Islands of the Four Mountains. One who went on the chopper is Max Kaufman, a research technician with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He's going to help install seismometers on Cleveland Volcano for the first time.
Getting these stations in will really help us understand its sort of background behavior. By instrumenting the island, we'll also provide some degree of safety for the crew working out there doing the archaeological studies.
Because, he says, you never know when the volcano might wake up. It's been a little restless in recent days, but Kaufman's hoping it'll stick to its usual low-level behavior. Still, he admits that the Islands of the Four Mountains are a bit of a daunting destination.
It seems quite remote, despite its proximity to Dutch Harbor.
So Kaufman and the other researchers will have to be ready for anything the islands throw at them, and so will the crew of their charter vessel, the Maritime Maid. It's been used for scientific charters before. Skipper George Raines says he's used to navigating the Aleutians' tricky coastlines.
It's a challenge. It's always probably been a challenge from the days the natives were out there, but Basically, you just have to be careful of the weather, move around, stay out of it.
12 members of the team can stay aboard the ship, while the rest will be camping on shore. Most of them will stay out on the islands for the next 3 weeks, hoping to start uncovering some of the mysteries that the Islands of the Four Mountains have in store. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The president of the University of Alaska has been offered a $320,000 bonus if he stays on the job until 2016. The Board of Regents last month voted to offer a contract extension to Pat Gamble that included the bonus, which is equal to 1 year of his salary. Some faculty members called the bonus inappropriate, with budget cuts and layoffs planned. The University of Alaska Fairbanks plans to lay off about 40 people to close a $12 million budget shortfall. Other campuses plan to leave open positions unfilled. University System spokeswoman Kate Ripley told the Alaska Dispatch News Gamble's pay package is modest compared to other university executives. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's growing industry selling peonies.
There's such a big demand. I don't know that Alaska will ever exceed the demand. Once you flood the lower 48, you still have Europe.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Doyon is building a new North Slope oil drilling rig. The Interior Regional Native Corporation will operate for ConocoPhillips. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Officials with the two companies announced the five-year extendable lease in Fairbanks Monday. Doyon President and CEO Aaron Schutt said the rig contract will mean new jobs.
It will employ directly about 80 new people for Doyon Drilling. And salary-wise, that's about $8 million annually.
Schutt said 50% of Doyon jobs are held by Native Corporation shareholders. The drilling rig will be Doyon's eighth on the North Slope. Schutt described the new rig as a growth opportunity worth the $100 million investment.
Contracts like these are what we hope for to grow our business long-term with a great client in an environment we know, the North Slope, and have been working in for 30 years.
The rig under construction in Alberta, Canada, is scheduled to begin work on the North Slope in spring of 2016. ConocoPhillips Alaska manager of drilling and wells, Mike Wietal, praised its unique design, which will enable it to work at both the Kuparuk and Alpine oil fields.
There is no rig in the North Slope right now that can cross the Colville River in the wintertime and still fit on all of our wells at Alpine. And we have over 200 wells at Alpine, so this is important to us. So this rig has been designed, you know, very, very carefully so that we can keep the weight down, it can cross the Colville River, but it can still work on all of the wells at Alpine.
Wietal tied the new rig deal with Doyon to the state's industry-friendly tax regime implemented under Senate Bill 21.
We're encouraged enough by the More Alaska Production Act, SB 21, to invest in projects like this.
Wietal said the new Doyon rig is the third ConocoPhillips has picked up since the passage of SB 21, but acknowledged that the company's North Slope rig count varies.
There's always rigs coming and going as our mix of projects changes, but we do expect to be up one rig at the point that this one is delivered in 2016.
The announcement comes less than a month before Alaska voters go to the polls to consider repeal of the oil tax reform bill. But Doyon Schutt denied the announcement's timing is purely political.
This type of investment is the type of investment that's coming to us in part because of SB 21. We're not shy to say that. In terms of the timing of this announcement, I would just encourage the cynics out there to look at the reality of the contracts and everything else that have come together over the summertime.
The ballot measure one oil tax referendum will be decided by voters in the August 19th primary. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Earlier this month, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's Port McKenzie took on a load of 16 miles of cement-coated pipe from a foreign vessel. The pipe now rests at the port, awaiting shipment to Nikiski to be used in construction of a new Cook Inlet oil platform. SKSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, although the pipe shipment has boosted borough revenues, some are asking questions about whether the port will ever be profitable.
Port McKenzie director Mark Van Dongen says the load of cement-coated pipe proves the port's heavy lifting capabilities.
Each piece of pipe is 42 feet long and it weighs 10,500 pounds. So we were lifting four pieces of pipe at a time off the ship, 42,000 pounds at a time, and placing them on flatbed trucks.
In March, Van Dongen told the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly that he wants more than $915,000 to run the port this year. That figure includes $135,000 for work on existing infrastructure that is to be paid for with a state grant. This year's Port McKenzie operating budget is close to $800,000.
With each vessel, Port McKenzie is doing exactly what it was designed to do.
Through advertisements like this one, the borough has been promoting the port as a necessity for the economic development of the area. Borough Manager John Moosey.
So we have a tremendous opportunity, and we're really looking for being the answer to our post-oil economy here in Alaska. We want to take a lead in that and a partnership with the state of Alaska.
Moosey says this year, because of federal accounting system changes, the port's budget will be paid for with the borough's operating funds. But Moosey says the port's profitability depends on a rail link to the port from Houston. That link is under construction but won't be completed for some time, possibly not before 2018. Port McKenzie has not turned a profit since 2008 when 451 tons of gravel was offloaded there. Van Dongen says that activity generated $832,000 profit in royalties, wharfage, and dockage fees. Van Dongen says this month's load of cement pipe is generating income, too.
It's going to depend on how long the pipe is sitting on the dock. There's a monthly charge per square foot that they're leasing the dock. They're leasing an office in our terminal building. There's wharfage, there's dockage for when the pipe comes in, and there's a different rate for when it goes out. Roughly, I'm estimating between $60,000 and $70,000 revenue from this one operation.
He, too, says that the rail link is vital to the port's continued economic health. But some have questioned whether or not the borough is throwing money into a ditch.
It's not feasible. It's not economically viable.
Grace Wedby is a Big Lake homeowner who has written a report critical of Port McKenzie and has also sided with local environmental groups in a lawsuit against construction of the rail link. Wedby, who is a contractor, says it is unlikely that Port McKenzie will ever make money because of its location. Wedby says currents at Port McKenzie are too fast for the safety of big freighters and that the ships have to travel further to get there than they do to get to the port in Seward. And she says if Alaska products are shipped out of state, it's cheaper to ship them by railroad to Seward.
As taxpayers, we're going to continue to pay on this until somebody wises up and say, how much more money are we going to put into it? I do not think that long run that port will ever be able to be a world port that is used to ship around the world.
The cement-covered pipe delivered to Port McKenzie this month was built in Korea, then sent to Mexico for the cement coating before it was shipped to Alaska. Van Dongen says Port McKenzie was the optimal destination because of the space available there for storing the pipe. He says near-term plans are to expand the port's customer base to include a fuel tank farm, and that negotiations are in the works with two companies interested in starting an LNG export operation at the port. Borough Manager Moosey says the borough's long-term plan regarding the port includes asking the state for money for a second dock. Moosey says that request won't be made until the railroad link is complete. At that time, the borough will firm up a marketing plan to attract more business to the port. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Yvonne Peter has been selected to run the University of Alaska Fairbanks rural campuses. He will serve as the new Vice Chancellor for Rural Community and Native Education. Peter is Gwich'in and Koyukon from Arctic Village. He graduated from UAF in 1998 with a bachelor's degree in Alaska Native Studies. He is finishing a master's degree in rural development. Peter is responsible for the College of Rural and Community Development, which includes all of UAF's rural campuses and sites. As Vice Chancellor, Yvonne Peter will be responsible for guiding UAF's rural and community education initiatives, promoting the inclusion of Indigenous knowledge in university programs, and advocating for Alaska Native education. Peter replaces Bernice Joseph, who died earlier this year after a battle with cancer. Momentum is building in the capital city to provide housing for the homeless who suffer from substance abuse. Housing First is based on the idea that the homeless can't deal with problems like alcoholism and medical issues until they have a permanent place to live. Anchorage and Fairbanks have Housing First facilities. In Juneau, some nonprofit organizations, city officials, and legislators think it's a good idea. As part of KTOO's series, Examining Downtown Problems, Lisa Fu reports on what's holding up the project.
57-year-old veteran Mark Molesky sits on a Telephone Hill Park bench on a cloudy July day. It's 1 p.m., and he's been drinking vodka. Molesky is homeless. Sometimes he sleeps right there in the park. The night before, though, he picked a spot outside the Arctic Bar on South Franklin Street.
I was sleeping on the street. The old lady said, come on, go walk. I said, I don't want to walk. I've got no destination. Let's walk.
Instead, Molesky was picked up.
Rainforest Discovery got hold of me.
Molesky spent the night in sleep off. It's not the first time that's happened and likely not the last. A Rainforest Recovery Center emergency vehicle patrols downtown Juneau 6 times a day, looking for people who are publicly intoxicated. Some inebriates are brought to Sleep Off, a room with 5 mattresses on the floor, where they can sleep until they're sober. Rainforest Recovery Director Jennifer Brown says a few people regularly use Sleep Off, as much as 20 times a month.
In addition to them using Rainforest, they're likely also high utilizers of other services, including the ER.
Of the estimated 600 homeless in Juneau, a 2012 survey found about 40 are considered vulnerable to dying prematurely on the street. Both Etheridge and Brown support the idea of a Housing First facility for this group.
Give people shelter, a safe place to be, and then try to wrap services around them, you see much greater success.
That's what Ken Scollin has seen at Carlick Manor in Anchorage, the original Housing First facility in Alaska.
We have 6 people working. We had 1 person here who got her CNA license, is currently working as a certified nurse's assistant.
Scollin is the affordable housing manager for the statewide nonprofit Rural Alaska Community Action Program, which runs Carlick Manor. When it opened in December 2011, 46 homeless alcoholics moved into their own efficiency apartments. Since then, Scollin says people drink less. Interactions between residents and police have decreased. 2 people have moved into their own apartments. Scollin says the concept is simple. With a place to call home and 24-hour support staff, residents are taking better care of themselves.
They now have an address. They have a phone. People are able to get a hold of them. If they have medical appointments, they're able to call here and set that up. We'll help them with their food stamp applications, their Social Security applications.
A barrier to bringing a Housing First project to Juneau is cost. A new facility is estimated at $7 million. Refurbishing an existing building could cost around $4 million. Supporters believe the savings to Juneau could be immense. Maria Lovashuk is executive director of the emergency shelter and soup kitchen Glory Hole. She believes the cost to a community drops dramatically when a Housing First facility is built.
The number of emergency room visits, the number of police pickups, the number of criminal charges, they drop so significantly. And the cost to the taxpayers drops so significantly.
Senator Dennis Egan hopes the legislature will consider an appropriation for a facility in Juneau. It's also a Juneau Assembly goal, and fundraising could start on the local level very soon. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Peonies are a growing business in Alaska. Ample sunlight and moisture make for good growing conditions, and more farmers are looking at the flowers as a profit maker. KTNA's Philip Manning visited a family farm in Trapper Creek and has the story.
When most people hear Alaskan exports, they think of things like gold, salmon, and oil. Now, however, some Alaskan farmers are capitalizing on the timing of the growing season to cash in on a new market, peonies. Peonies are a family of flower with somewhere between 25 and 40 species. The blossoms contain many petals and can open to be quite large, with the flower of many species averaging 6 inches across or more. In Alaska, some can get even larger.
They were bigger than my head.
That's Pat Holloway. She's the professor of horticulture at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and she's describing some of the flowers in her own garden this summer. Professor Holloway is a big part of the reason that farmers are growing peonies in Alaska. She says she spoke with a flower industry expert nearly 15 years ago who told her that Alaska is in a unique position to grow peonies commercially.
Ours bloom in July instead of the May where most people have peonies. And he pointed that out to me. He says, if you look into the world markets on cut flowers, he says, nobody has peonies blooming in July.
Armed with that knowledge, Professor Holloway obtained grant funding to start trying to grow peonies in Alaska. Because the growth was being carefully documented, Holloway says she got an unexpected phone call 2 years into the experiment.
In 2003, I was in my office and I got a phone call and this gentleman introduced himself as a flower broker from London and he wanted me to send him 100,000 stems.
Part of the reason for year-round demand for peonies is how they're used. Brian Hoffman, whose family grows peonies in Trapper Creek, says the flowers are in high demand around the world for one specific occasion.
Seems to be bridal bouquets.
Marilyn Hoffman, Brian's wife, says that they discovered peonies as an Alaskan crop as a matter of necessity.
Our first year moving up here, all of this, all 3 acres of this was hay. And we found out that our son was allergic to hay, so we had to figure out something different.
Part of that research that Brian Hoffman saw was what Professor Holloway had produced. Now the family grows 3 acres of peonies. It's a learning process for the Hoffmans. Marilyn explains how cutting the flowers is different in Alaska because florists want them while they're still in bud stage.
You're out here 4 times a day. You know, you're constantly in the field and checking buds. And then last year, even from midnight, would be my last cut to 6 o'clock in the morning. I would have so many blown that I couldn't send to distributor because they were already too far open.
The Hoffmans are far from alone in peony farming in the area. The Matsu Borough recently designated itself as the peony capital of Alaska. Brian Hoffman says that farmers in the valley are all working on the best way to grow the flowers and often share information on what's working for them within the relatively new industry.
But up here, everybody's still trying to figure it out. There's, you know, a lot of communications between farmers in the area. You know, we talk to a lot of farmers and, hey, what's working for you? We tried this. It didn't work for us. A lot of information sharing.
Brian Hoffman says that one of the reasons farmers feel comfortable sharing techniques is that Alaska has a corner on the market that it's nowhere close to exhausting.
There's such a big demand. I don't know that Alaska will ever exceed the demand.
Okay.
I mean, once you flood the lower 48, you still have Europe.
Right.
You still have the rest of the world.
The supply in Alaska and on the Hoffman's farm is continuing to grow, but still has a long way to go before the hundreds of thousands of flowers that distributors, florists, and wedding planners are asking for can be exported. This week, flower distributors were touring farms across Alaska, and by all accounts, they were impressed not only with the extended peony season, but also the quality of the flowers that grow under the midnight sun. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Philip Manning in Trapper Creek. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.